Let's jump into the 70s, because this is where we pick you up with President Jimmy Carter. How did you connect with him? Did you support him from the get-go? How did you get involved with Carter?
I was active in politics here, precinct chairman, and at one time I was the chairman of the district Democratic Party. You know, I was sort of active. In those days, if you gave $1,000 to a presidential candidate, you almost got him over to your house. I remember almost a one-on-one meeting with Mondale, and I was one of a handful of people who gave him $1,000. But anyway, when the Jimmy Carter came thing, I went out to Oral Roberts to hear Jimmy Carter speak. And I remember coming out of that meeting and saying, that's the first time I've ever heard a candidate use the word Jesus Christ in a speech. I said, you know, this guy is definitely a religious guy, and he's different. So we had our precinct meetings, and I had decided to support Carter, although I was also tempted to support Udall. And in retrospect, I think Udall might have made a better president. But at any rate, I supported Carter. I was elected at the precinct, and then I went to another meeting and another meeting and another meeting. Finally, I got to the district meeting, and I was selected as one of two delegates to the National Convention. In those days, we're talking about actual selection of delegates at the district level, and the other person was Peggy Cadenhead, whose husband was a congressional candidate at one time, and she was a good Democrat. The two of us and one other were designated as delegates. Well, this was very early in the process. After I was selected and Peggy was selected, there were only 12 delegates in the United States, Carter delegates. I mean, this was one of the first, I think it was the first state. So I was active in the Carter campaign. When he got elected, I thought, well, you know, I ought to try to go to Washington. And I remember it was very difficult. We didn't really have the kind of inside position that some people did. I mean, the guys who were actually on the campaign, and we weren't from Georgia, and so forth and so on. And I remember putting my name in the hat for the only thing that I could hold my head up and say I could handle, which was Assistant Attorney General for Lands. And I remember they picked a general counsel of the Sierra Club for that job. And being an oil man and an oil country guy, I had no chance. Anyway, I sort of forgot about it. But a friend of mine knew that I had had an interest in it and called me about a year later and said, a friend of mine is putting together a wing of the Department of Energy. I've told him about you, and would you be interested in coming up? So I flew up, met with this guy, met with Schlesinger. The department had just been set up, and it really didn't know exactly how it was going to work. And I was given a very big brief. I mean, as the Democrats are today, they're very anti hydrocarbons. You know, it's a party that's loaded with tree huggers. For instance, they took all the oily stuff and they put it under one deputy assistant secretary, which was me. So I had this huge brief. I ran the Naval Petroleum Reserves. I ran the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which grew to be the biggest reserve in the world. And I ran the oil shale program. I ran the offshore leasing program. And I ran the oil and gas program. I mean, I had this huge thing. I had a $4 billion budget. But I was really sort of peripheral in the department because they were so interested in things like wind and solar and conservation and so forth. I was just sort of the dirty guy that was. But anyway, I enjoyed the time up there, and I spent about 3 years up there.
So that was in 1977?
1977 to 81. Mm-hmm. Interesting little sideline I tell people who are in Washington. When your president gets beat and you're a political appointee, the thing to do is to call your real estate dealer immediately, sell your house, and be prepared to move out, because you never make the transition. What I did was, I thought, well, I'll just stay here until they fire me. So they let me go. And, of course, I didn't have any other alternatives. I had no job.
In 76, Jimmy Carter had been elected, and you went to work for him in 77.
Yeah. I'd quit my law firm. I'd sold my house. There I was up in Washington, D.C., no job, in this expensive Washington house. And Carter had just been defeated. Well, instead of quitting, I just stayed on. That would have been November, so I stayed on November, December, and in January I got a mimeographed note that said, I'd like to have your resignation by noon today.
We should point out that Ronald Reagan then defeated Jimmy Carter in 1980.
So I was there till the inauguration, January 20th, 81. But anyway, I always sort of wondered, when they fire the officers, how do they do it? Well, they send you a little piece of paper. No one calls you in. They send you a little piece of paper that says, please have your resignation on somebody's desk by noon today. So at that point, I was out of a job. I had this big Washington house.
Did you have any children by that time?
Oh, yeah. I had four. I had four in Tulsa. And I took them all up with me to be with Jimmy Carter, which was a huge problem. I mean, you know, four new schools and dentists and doctors. But anyway, so then I turned around and came back to Tulsa. Now, some guys stayed there, but I couldn't see a path, so I came back to Tulsa.
What was your impression of the Carter administration, of him personally? Did you have face-to-face time with him at all?
No, not much. I mean, I've met him a couple of times, and I gave speeches in the White House and so forth. But as far as FaceTime, where I was is my level wasn't very high. On the organizational chart, you have a secretary, and then you have a deputy secretary, and then you have a whole raft of assistant secretaries. And they're sort of like the generals. And then under the assistant secretaries, you have deputy assistant secretaries, and that's what I was. A deputy assistant secretary in the right position is a wonderful job. A famous nuclear engineer, Rickover, was a deputy assistant secretary. Normally, if you see a deputy assistant secretary on television, he really knows what he's talking about because the permanent staff reports to the deputy assistant secretary. By the time it gets to the assistant secretary, it's gone through one level of filter. By the time it gets to the secretary, it's gone through about three levels of filter. So the secretaries are always talking in generalities and generally don't really know what's happening. The deputies really know exactly what's up. For instance, I was running the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and I literally flew by helicopter around all the sites. I literally went out to Elk Hills and talked to the guys producing the oil and looked at the wells and all this kind of business. I went out to Colorado and looked at the oil shale sites. So I had a wonderful job, except that you're not well known outside the department because generally it's the assistant secretaries who make the press releases and so forth.
What kind of money were you paid for that job?
$58,000.
Was that considered?
It's interesting because I went back again for the Clinton administration and they had doubled it to $126,000. Well, it was a lot less than I was making in Tulsa, but it was not less than most people were making. During that period of time, law business for our firm and for me was relatively lucrative. So it was a big cut in pay.
So why did you do this? Why did you continue on? And
life's too short not to take an opportunity. And of course, the point is that opportunity does not knock. And a lot of my friends have been bitten by this. When it's time that you want to go to Washington or you want to do something new, nobody's asking. I noticed this with teaching. You know, all my older lawyer friends say, well, I'd like to teach. Well, you have to pay your dues. You have to get started early. I mean, you just don't reach fruition, and you just don't go to Washington when you want to. And this was a chance to go to Washington. I thought probably the only one I ever had, and it was.
It was a good experience. You enjoyed
it.
What was a highlight or two from your experience there?
Well, first of all, the department had just been set up, and we had probably the hottest name in America as our secretary, Schlesinger.
Arthur Schlesinger.
Yeah, he'd been Secretary of Defense, and he had been head of the OMB, and he'd also been head of the CIA. I mean, he was a tremendously powerful man, and he and I hit it off pretty well because he was a realist and a hard-nosed guy, and he was not a moose-and-goose kind of guy, whereas we had a lot of people in the department who were. One of the more difficult things I ever had was we had a blowout in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve down in Louisiana. Those salt caverns filled with oil are under quite a bit of pressure, and when you change the tubing, they can blow out and catch fire. One did, blew out, caught fire, killed two men, big congressional hearing, and of course, they blamed us for it. And I remember going into Schlesinger's office and some of what I would consider my adversaries in the bureaucracy, you always have adversaries, had controlled who was going to be the number one investigator on this disaster. And this disaster was of huge national and international prominence because what you had was 50,000 barrels burned up, turned into a gigantic Roman candle with smoke you could see for every. And we had two deaths. So we got this report. What had happened is a subcontractor had hired a subcontractor called Baker, which is famous Packer company. And the guy who did the Packer, who was sleeping in his car while it was going on, had miscalculated the pressure on this Packer. And, you know, a Packer is a rubber thing that sticks in the, supposed to hold so many pounds pressure. Well, anyway, he miscalculated it, and the Packer blew out like a cork out of a bottle, and the oil came in, the gas came out and caught fire. There was no real government flaw. Well, anyway, the report roasted all of us. I remember going into Schlesinger's office. I had him this report, and he looked at this report, and he was one of these kind of guys that looked like he was always just about ready to have some kind of a blow-up. He took this piece of paper I gave him, and he threw it across the room. And he said, "We had one disaster, now we have two." But anyway, it was fun. I got to go to the White House and make speeches, and I got to go to the National Security Council and meet, you know, for Oki, who instant government is a constant titillation. And, of course, I learned a lot, and it was really sort of a shame to go up there so ignorant about the way Washington worked. And, of course, Carter himself was sort of ignorant. He got smarter and smarter, and he would have been a wonderful president the second term, but by that time he had burned his bridges. Carter came up there being really green, and he did a lot of stupid things.
What about the bureaucrats at Work Washington? That's their life calling, and they're there forever and ever. Are they talented people? Are you impressed by them?
Yeah, I'm very impressed. In the Department of Energy, we got the cream of the cream because a brand new department, huge budget. It was the energy crisis, and there were lines of cars. Many of the people we got were people from other departments who had to fight and scrap to get put into energy. Now, I went back 20 years later, and the same people were there, and it was sort of stodgy and less impressive. But the best people in Washington work harder than anyone I've ever met in the private sector. Anybody. I mean, if you look at the White House or the executive office building lights at night and early morning and weekend, you see those lights burning. Those are people working. I mean, it is not at all unusual to have Saturday meetings, Sunday meetings, work till midnight. The superstars, they actually use that phrase, are usually people who are GS-14s and up, GS-15s. The GS-15 is paid the same that a deputy assistant secretary is paid. But these guys work incredibly hard, and they have degrees, and they're smart. This idea of a bunch of sleepy bureaucrats is really not true at all. And the other thing is it's very honest. We were trying to settle a case with DuPont, and I went up to Michigan, and they took us all out to the country club for lunch, and I had a club sandwich. We went back to our negotiations. When I got back home, there was a $17 check on my desk to send to DuPont. We never had a lunch that we didn't pay for. So if I had a guy from Tulsa who was a friend of mine come up and take me to lunch, I didn't go through this. But I had one rule, and that is I never had a lunch, never had anything where we didn't compensate them. Now, the Hill was a completely different thing. I mean, the Hill was like a brothel up there. I mean, it was so disappointing to see how the Hill operated. I mean, they had no supervision. They took whatever they could get. I one time flew out to California for a testimony. We'd had an oil spill. So we go out there and we take Air Force Two. Department of Energy had to pay somebody for Air Force Two. I had $35 per diem in San Francisco. Maybe it was $45. And the Congress guys had no per diem. The night we got out there, they all went to La Bourguignon, which was one of their fancy restaurants, at $200 a plate, and booze and party. And I was over there eating at a Chinese dim sum, trying to get by my $45 a day. And that's sort of the way the Hill and the executive branch work. The Hill is an undisciplined, wild, wild west.
We're talking about our senators and our representatives when you say that.
They talk about their staff, yeah. And of course the senators too. I mean, they take all these trips. But there's really not much supervision over Congress except for the press. Yeah. And if the press doesn't blow the whistle, whereas in the Department of Energy, if you did anything controversial, we had an inspector general who would come in and blow the whistle on you. So there's no inspector general for the Hill. Most of those guys are honest enough, but look at Tom DeLay, you know, those trips overseas and improve.
Well, he's paying a price for that. He faces a 3-year prison sentence right now. But the bureaucrats, as you say, work so hard, not major pay, I suppose. Why do they do that? Couldn't they?
Well, it's like many of these people, and of course I'm talking about maybe the highlight of American bureaucracy, because we had a new department, it was messianic. A lot of it is personal ambition, because you can't get promoted and better jobs unless you have a good reputation. And you get a guy like Henry Kissinger, Simon, and all these guys, they were famous for what they call torquing their staff. Basically, if you're not in there on Saturday, and you're not in there late at night, and you don't get that report out that he gave you at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he wants tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, you know, he just moves to another job and he takes his good people and leaves you down the bowels of the department. So a lot of it is personal ambition in order to continue. There's always a higher level. Some of it's just patriotism or desire to do a good job. And, of course, there are some people who really don't do very much. But at my level, I mean, nobody ever got to the level where they're dealing with a deputy assistant secretary unless the guy had spent a lot of late nights putting stuff out, because there's just a tremendous amount of paper being shuffled. And it's hard to shuffle paper. It's hard to write good reports and have them on time and that sort of thing.